In his new book, the historian Benjamin Park tells about a day in April of 1844. This is in the Mormon city of Nauvoo, Illinois, where the faithful had gathered and established a place for themselves after being thrown out of communities in Missouri. The American experience, American democracy, wasn't really working for the Mormons. So their founder, Joseph Smith, gathered some of the men in Nauvoo together on April 14th. Park says it was one of the most radical political organizations in 19th century America.
April in Nauvoo was especially rainy, and it was on the heels of a very cold winter. At the same time, not only is rain falling down around them, all the walls that the saints believed that they had built to protect their kingdom of God on the Mississippi River, Nauvoo, those walls seem to be collapsing as well. So they were wondering, what happens if Nauvoo ends up not being this Mecca, this safe haven, this empire that we imagine? They gathered in the upstairs room of one of their meeting halls in this new clandestine organization that they referred to as the Kingdom of God, or the colloquially as the Council of 50. They did perhaps one of the most radical proposals of antebellum America. They proposed a new constitution. Their new constitution that they proposed in April 1844 gave God a voice in the affairs of men, declared that all laws come from a divine order. And so what the Mormons were trying to establish was, in their own words, a theocracy. Some said that it felt like the millennium had just ushered in. There was one participant who went home and wrote in his diary, "It felt like heaven had begun on earth." Another one wrote out that it felt like we were walking on hallowed grounds, on sacred landscape. They knew that what they were doing was audacious. They are speaking as if the world is about to be transformed and their theocratic government is going to come in control. The first article then recognized God as the creator of all laws. The second article said that things are going to be mediated through priesthood leaders. And the third article said that there are going to be judges to make sure that all laws are implemented justly toward all citizens. And then it stops. It turns out that writing a constitution was a lot harder than they expected. They had been working on it for about a month, and when they finally came up with it, they were like, oh, we got a preamble and three articles, and that's about it. And then a week later, Joseph Smith declares, you know what? We don't need a written constitution. The beauty of a theocratic council is that I have God's chosen leaders here, and we can be the constitution itself, a living document. They believe that the American government had proved ill-fitted and unwilling to step in and protect the rights of marginalized groups. Further, not just protecting the rights of marginalized groups, but protecting the rights of God's elect. And that's what the story of Nauvoo is. A story of people worrying that America's democratic experiment had run its course, and now it was time to try something else.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's not exactly a spoiler to say Joseph Smith's grand idea of Nauvoo didn't work. Now, a good part of this was Smith's own fault. Historians have written about how the controversial practice of polygamy and his oversized ambition doomed the experiment. But Benjamin Park says the reason for building Nauvoo in the first place, and the reason it failed, has as much to do with the limits of American democracy as anything else. Today in the program, Park is joining us to talk about his new book. It's called Kingdom of Nauvoo. Now, this all began for Park when he started reading the meeting minutes of this organization in Nauvoo in the 1840s. It was called the Council of 50, a super secret organization that talked about replacing the American system with a theocratic kingdom. And for 172 years, these minutes had been kept from outsiders and scholars like Park.
There was a man who was appointed to be the secretary for this new Council of 50. His name was William Clayton. He had already served as a private secretary for Joseph Smith for years, so he had experience at this. But when he was appointed the secretary for this new council, the Council of 50, he knew that this council was going to be significant. He knew that the words that were going to be uttered in their meetings could solve the world's problems. And so he took detailed minutes and shorthand minutes in his in loose leaf papers, and he'd go home and he'd copy them into bigger minute books because he wanted to preserve this record. Now, when Joseph Smith saw the political ramifications of his actions coming to fruit in June of 1844, after he ordered the destruction of a dissident press, after the governor had issued an arrest warrant in his name, and after he had decided to turn himself into the state and try his luck in the court, he knew that those Council of 50 minutes could be a big problem, because not only would they be seen as salacious in the wrong hands, but they could be seen as treasonous. They were trying to propose a new government to replace the American system. And so he turned to William Clayton, and he told William Clayton, "I want you to go burn those minutes." Now, fortunate for all of us, William Clayton decided to disobey his president, and instead of burning them, he buried them in the garden outside of his house. After a few months passed and the crisis seemed to subside, at least for the moment, William Clayton then went out and dug them up. But those minutes might as well have remained buried for decades, and indeed over a century and a half, because as the saints moved westward and as the church became more formally organized, those records continued to be seen as dangerous or as discordant, especially once the LDS church became more assimilated within the broader American culture. Minutes in which church leaders are explicitly viewing the destruction of America or denouncing American democracy just aren't good PR documents. And so they remain sequestered, secluded, confidential. They're not, historians, both faithful and critical, are not allowed a chance to even get a glance at them. Until about 2013, when the LDS Church announced their release, and they were finally published as part of the Joseph Smith Papers Project series in 2016, where they were finally released to the general public. Now, whereas with most people, we're a bit disappointed with the minutes contents. They were hoping for something even more salacious. There were rumors that there was a coronation ceremony of Joseph Smith. There were rumors that the saints were plotting the assassination of a sitting U.S. president. So some people were a bit disappointed that wasn't as salacious as it could have been. I saw these documents and immediately thought, oh my goodness, this is the most potent expression of widespread democratic discontent in antebellum America that I've ever seen. And so when I saw those minutes, I saw there's a broader story there. And I set out to write a book that kind of gave the long backstory and broader cultural context to what can be seen as one of the most significant, if long rumored, LDS documents in existence.
Let's back up before we get to Nauvoo itself and talk about the experience in Missouri. I mean, this is a long and complicated story, but sum up that experience for us. There were a lot of tensions. Joseph Smith had believed that Missouri was going to be Zion, but it doesn't turn out that way, and they have to move on. But the experience in Missouri, that's their crucible, at least at that time.
Yeah, and very much so. And I would even argue that most of Nauvoo is kind of a post-traumatic stress disorder episode after Missouri. Because in Missouri, the Mormons not only had problems with their neighbors, but they lost the support of the state government. Indeed, the state government turned out to be an enemy to them, resulting in what we call the Mormon-Missouri War. Now, the most bloody episodes of this include a massacre of men, women, and children at Hans Mill, one of the Mormon settlements, as well as a number of occasions where Mormons went on the offensive and their small vigilante groups would march into other societies and try to restore, in their version, justice. This all resulted, of course, with the governor of Missouri, Lilburn Boggs, signing what comes to be known as the Extermination Order, an executive order that declared the saints were nuisances, enemies of the state, who must either be exterminated or driven from Missouri's boundaries. Now, having a state-sanctioned mob and an extermination order is going to do a lot to a community's psyche. So when the Mormons establish in Illinois, they do two things. One, we need to endear ourselves to the state government. We don't want another Lilburn Boggs situation. But two, we have to build enough barriers to protect protect us, that if things do go south, if we do lose the support of the state and the neighboring communities, we need to have our own methods of defense. And so they do things like establish a city militia called the Nauvoo Legion. It led them to create new legal practices in Nauvoo that granted them the ability to try all arrest warrants that originate outside Nauvoo as a way to kind of shield church authorities from what they feared would be a wrong-headed justice. So their trials in Missouri to the saints showed to them that the democratic system, if not manipulated correctly, could very quickly turn bloody, as it had with them in their previous settlements.
Let me ask you about Nauvoo itself as a place. When they arrive in 1839, founded by Joseph Smith, it was called Commerce at the time. What was it like? It was beautiful, not easy to tame, you mention. It had been a region that was home to several Native American tribes. What did it look like? What was appealing about this space, this place, for Joseph Smith?
Yeah. There is a lot that the space had for it. It was on a very scenic bend of the Mississippi River. And, of course, the Mississippi River is the lifeblood of America's new capitalistic system. It's a way that you can get goods through this new western frontier area where we're going to have lots of farmland and lots of commercial activities down to New Orleans, out the port, and into not just the broader America, but into the Atlantic world. So having a nice scenic spot along the Mississippi River is going to be crucial. That's why some of the early settlers call it Commerce, because it's going to be part of this new economic system. However, it was very hard to tame. Very few people were willing to go out and live in an unsettled territory. Now, the first people to live there, of course, were the Native Americans, as you mentioned. They called the region Quashkima, and it was known for its ability to be a trading hub. But once the Native Americans were dispossessed and forced off the land, it was supposed to be sold as payment to war veterans. War veterans were not interested to go out and settle their own. So a series of speculators keep buying it, one after another, hoping that they're going to be able to find the group of people to finally establish what should be a very positive potential settlement place. It's not until the saints in 1839 stumble upon it that Isaac Galland, one of these speculators who has accumulated lots of lot in the land, sell it to the Mormons. And the Mormons see that it's got this beautiful location, great for trade, great especially for them because they're going to have lots of immigrants coming in from Britain and they can come up the Mississippi River and get off at their own port. But in the first couple of years, they also realized another reason why very few people settled there long term. It was a swamp-ridden place that was filled with malaria-carrying mosquitoes. And so the first two summers, when the saints are settled in Nauvoo, you have deaths at an extraordinary rate. They had weekly funeral services. Nearly every family in Nauvoo was affected. But once they were able to drain the swamp and set up their a rudimentary economic system there, they were finally able to find a sense of permanency, and Nauvoo came close to reaching what was initially supposed to be its economic potential.
Nauvoo had its own militia, its own legion. How unique was this? Because you write about how it raised these questions for Illinois residents who are nervous about Mormons. You know, who was this militia loyal to? Was it loyal to the state? Was it loyal to Joseph Smith? And it was big and it was armed.
Yeah. Theoretically, the Nauvoo Legion was an extension of the state militia. Serving in the Nauvoo Legion exempted you from serving the state troops. Many cities had the same provision. But the Mormons take a very common practice and practice it on steroids, take it to the next degree. Every male citizen, every adult male in Nauvoo was required to serve in the Nauvoo Legion. Not just serve, but participate in all their marches, all their rallies, all their drills. Joseph Smith found a few more pleasurable experiences than marshaling the Legion around him and seeing the power that his position could now wield. At its height, the Nauvoo Legion claimed close to about 3,000 men.
Wow.
And they were remarkably well-armed because one of the early citizens of Nauvoo, who rose to a high stature, a fascinating figure by the name of John C. Bennett, was the quartermaster general for the state militia before joining the LDS Church and moving to Nauvoo. So he was able to leverage that position to make sure that the Nauvoo Legion got all the resources they needed. So to the Mormons, they saw this Nauvoo Legion as a bulwark of liberty, that if all other defenses fail them, they could at least protect themselves, do what they felt they were not able to do in Missouri. Outside of Nauvoo, that Legion was the visual manifestation of the threat that Nauvoo posed.
What was it like for non-Mormons to live there? Which raises, to me anyway, the question of whether or not this, in fact, was kind of just a theocracy. There's this story you tell in the book about how it was civic authorities, city authorities, who were giving these certificates to citizens who were supposed to be paying their tithing that would contribute to the building of the temple. I mean, that's an entirely church function, but being administered by city officials. Did that illustrate what it was like there?
Yeah, no, that's a great example of how the religious authority dynamic worked in Nauvoo. Now, there are a number of quotes from Joseph Smith in the early Nauvoo period that typically get shared about religious liberty, that Joseph Smith was all about everyone being able to practice whatever faith they wanted. And that was true. They had exceptionally broad religious liberty laws in Nauvoo. But Joseph Smith defined religious liberty a bit differently than we might define it today. He would define it as religious liberty as a liberty to practice the correct religion, to respect the right authority. And you could be a Gentile living in Nauvoo. You can not be a Mormon and participate in Nauvoo's functions as long as you respect the proper authority. In fact, the Joseph Smith Papers project editors have been working on these legal papers from Nauvoo, where Joseph Smith, as part of the municipal court, was involved in all these court cases. And they've been able to decipher that most of the cases in which someone is tried for breaking the laws concerning religious liberty did so because Joseph Smith said that they were questioning his authority. And now, that doesn't square with our modern conceptions of religious liberty, but I think it captures this vision that Joseph had of perfect unity and collaboration in Nauvoo, which even if you might have these private beliefs, you are supposed to still respect the proper authoritative figures.
That's Benjamin E. Park. He's an assistant professor at Sam Houston State University. We're talking about his new book, Kingdom of Nauvoo, The Rise and Fall of a Religious Empire on the American Frontier. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
There's a label, you could call it a religious identity, that has become a little more mainstream lately.
It's not really been socially acceptable to call yourself a witch, except for within the past few decades.
This week on Preach, the Oracle of Los Angeles. She explains why the magic she practices is probably different than what comes to mind, and how witchcraft can help you heal from trauma. Find Preach wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the historian Benjamin Park is joining us to discuss his new book about the experience of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Nauvoo, Illinois. This is where the founder, Joseph Smith, would introduce some of the most remarkable theocratic innovations of the faith, like polygamy and baptisms for the dead and a tiered system of heaven. But it was also where these early Mormons would conceive of an alternative to American democracy— a theocracy, in fact, governed by the priesthood. The book is called Kingdom of Nauvoo. So I want to talk about some of the innovations that Joseph Smith comes up with in Nauvoo, because it seems like he goes on fire with new ideas once he gets settled in Nauvoo. And one of the innovations you write about, for example, in this Nauvoo period is baptisms for the dead. I wanted you to say a little bit about that. One of the things I noticed is you mentioned the rules that Joseph Smith establishes then for doing these baptisms for the dead, which, for those who don't know, are a common practice of the modern LDS Church, of course. But one of the requirements then for Smith was that they had to have angelic visitations from their dead relatives to perform them.
Yeah, though the vicarious baptisms for the dead came in one of Joseph Smith's most theologically innovative periods of his career. When the saints get settled in Nauvoo, their first full year, there Joseph Smith finally has a freedom to present some of the ideas that he might have been holding close to him for a number of years, and he might be innovating new ideas, receiving new revelations, however you want to frame it. And then that year of 1840, as I mentioned before, the saints of Nauvoo were struck with a rampant string of deaths related to the malaria that was being spread by mosquitoes. And so when faced with this tragic reality of death and coupled with Joseph Smith's new theological innovations coming out from the period, he's able to propose these new solutions that Nauvoo is going to be the epicenter of saving thousands of humanity's loss through these different ordinances. And at the center of all this, of course, was a reaffirmation of the centrality of priesthood authority. Because what these vicarious baptisms for the dead do is it grants individuals the priesthood authority to reach beyond the grave and save those who did not have the chance to be saved while they were living. Now, the vicarious baptism for the dead is just one example for this. And it's not a coincidence that doctrine is preached for the first time as Joseph Smith is directing the building of a new temple that's going to be built on the bluff. Because the vicarious baptisms, that's just the first step. Over the next few years, Joseph Smith is going to introduce a number of new rituals, all predicated around this idea of priesthood governance, that are going to create a salvific family of individuals who can be saved, transcend death, and overcome any opposition and trauma that might come in the saints' way.
You mention in the book that really probably the first reason for Nauvoo's significance is that Mormon polygamy begins there. And it's often understood by today's Latter-day Saints, certainly the active ones, as this decree that just comes from God, you know, wholly formed, that it was given to Joseph Smith in that way. But you describe it, in fact, as a practice that developed kind of haphazardly and over the course of several months, if not years.
Right. That was something that really jumped out to me as reading the documents, because whether you see polygamy as divinely initiated through a prophetic leader or instituted through a patriarchal leader who's wanting to both justify his lusts and create some form of order, either of those approaches typically result in someone seeing it as these explicit instructions arriving sometime in early Nauvoo and staying the same until Joseph Smith is dead. But as I looked into the history of polygamy in Nauvoo, I was amazed at how much it evolved, changing depending on who is added to the practice, what new ideas are considered, who are they trying to convince, what are the different theological justifications used for the practice. So whereas Joseph Smith first introduces polygamy in early 1841, a lot of his first plural wives, not all, but most, are already married to other men, some even faithful and members of the church who hold leadership positions. And it seems like polygamy was a way to combine families together in a sense of dynastic order. Just like priesthood authority is going to govern people in their religious vein, this polygamous order is going to govern people in the domestic vein. But then after the Book of Abraham and another number of other theological innovations in early 1842, we see a transition of polygamy. Suddenly, wives are younger, they're of child-rearing age, there's a broader expectation. They start calling it the practice of Abraham. So it's a way to fulfill the Abrahamic covenant of righteous patriarchs, being able to have progeny as numerous as the sands on the seashore. And then you see polygamy being used as a way to convince men as, hey, this is a way that you can be sealed both to your deceased spouse as well as your living spouse, solving a Gordian knot that had haunted many elite men in Nauvoo who had lost a wife in previous years and were now married to another and wondering how that they can be sealed to both. That's a doctrine that ends up convincing Hiram Smith, Joseph Smith's own brother. So, and then after Joseph Smith dies, polygamy is a way for Brigham Young and the Quorum of the Twelve to take control of the church, to gain Joseph Smith's mantle, not by just having the keys to the temple and the leadership of the church, but having dynastic leadership over these increasingly expanding familial kingdoms.
Benjamin, will you tell the story of the night before the cornerstone ceremony for the Nauvoo Temple? This is April 5th, and this might be the first polygamous marriage or sealing. I think it's a really interesting story for a number of reasons. One is that no one except for very, very, very few people, and certainly not Joseph Smith's wife, knew anything about it.
Yeah, April 6th, 1841 was going to be the biggest day in Nauvoo up till that point. It was going to be the cornerstone ceremony for the temple, this huge structure being built on the bluff to overlook the inchoate city below. There's going to be a band, musicians playing, a parade, thousands of attendees, not just within Nauvoo, but dignified visitors like Stephen A. Douglas, a state politician, from outside of Nauvoo. But it's the night before that we have another ceremony, on April 5th, that Joseph Smith gathers with just two people, Louisa Beeman, a longtime member of the church, and Joseph Noble, a close friend of Joseph Smith. Now, none of these three people leave a written record at the time. Hmm. Only Joseph Noble ever discussed it, and he does it decades later. And whereas thousands know about the cornerstone ceremony the next day, these three keep their activity in secret. Because at that gathering on the night of April 5th, Joseph Noble acts as officiator and seals his sister-in-law, Louisa Beeman, to Joseph Smith as Joseph Smith's first plural wife. Now, even though there's this stark contrast between these two episodes, the private polygamous ceremony and the public cornerstone ceremony, the same doctrines justified both, that God's order was here to restore organization and authority to a chaotic world, just like the temple was going to be the hinge upon which modernity pivoted, that's going to bring rituals and ordinances and authority to the religious world, bridging heaven and earth. This polygamous union the night before is going to restore God's patriarchal order. Mm. It's going to say that it's going to dissolve human temporary relationships and introduce divine eternal relationships. And that's so why I already knew that there was going to be a connection between these political, temple, and polygamous rites. But when I was able to realize that these events took place within hours of each other, that captured how intertwined those practices were.
Do we know if he had sex with her? And how important was the idea of sex, you know, the consummation of a marriage? How important was it to these sealings, as they came to be called? Because one of the things you mention in the book is that it's just too simplistic to say that this was just about sex for Joseph Smith, that he had created this big, complicated concept to just justify an extramarital affair.
Right. And the simple answer is we don't fully know, but we can take some guesses. With Louisa Beeman specifically, Joseph Noble later says that Joseph and Louisa have like a one-night honeymoon at Joseph Noble's house, which was outside of Nauvoo. So we have some reason to suspect that sealing was consummated. Other sealings, we're not so sure. Some of the sealings, especially with women who already had husbands, there seems to be evidence that there was not a consummation. But after the Abrahamic term, is what I call it, in early 1842, when Joseph Smith produces the later chapters of the Book of Abraham, and polygamy takes a different approach, in my view, it seems like sex and consummation was expected to be part of it. Hmm. Now, there, of course, is the question, where's the children? If Joseph Smith is sealed to over 30 women in Nauvoo, why is it that the only children, verified children, that we have from him come from his wife, Emma? Well, I think part of that is because the circumstances in Nauvoo made that very difficult. This is a very small and crowded city. Even Joseph Smith does not have a home to himself, as he's renting out rooms within his Nauvoo mansion. And there's not very many chances to get private time with someone, especially when there's prying eyes. Polygamy was not just salacious, it was illegal. And so they were trying to hide it. I just don't think that the circumstances in Nauvoo was one that would be conducive to procreation that we might otherwise expect for these marital unions that seem to be intent in some way on offspring.
I want to ask you about one figure in particular, one of Joseph Smith's plural wives, Eliza Snow. I think a lot of people around here know that name. They know her well. Because I think her story may help some understand why women would enter into these plural marriages of their own will. Snow, you mentioned, of course, she's cultured, she's educated, she's dignified, she's a poet and a thinker. And she gets married in one of these – she chooses to enter into this plural marriage with Joseph Smith in 1842. And you mentioned a few reasons. And what I wanted to ask you about was that, you know, of course, she's deeply committed to the Mormon cause, you say. But you also mentioned something else that I wanted to ask you about. You say that it's possible that Eliza Snow may have experienced sexual trauma in that tumultuous time of persecution in Missouri. And it may have revealed the anxiety and the anger that she and maybe others may have felt toward the rest of society. So here again, polygamy offered her a reaction to that, a sense of, again, order and stability?
Yeah, very much so. Now, I should say that much of this work is based on excellent scholars who have already dug into Eliza R. Snow's experience in Missouri, most notably Andrea Radke Moss, who wrote a wonderful article about sexual violence in Missouri. But Eliza R. Snow is a fascinating figure to trace the very tensions that you outlined, Doug, because unlike nearly all other plural wives of Joseph Smith, she leaves a contemporary record. Now, she doesn't explicitly say she's talking about polygamy, but in her diary, on the night that she is sealed to Joseph Smith as a plural wife, she starts talking about the priesthood order. And she starts talking about being confused, but also seeking the permanency. And she digs into these very themes that we've been discussing. She compares the anarchy and the chaos of the world around them that only brought loss and division and violence and trauma to the permanence and the stability that was offered by Joseph Smith's covenant and the priesthood of the gospel. She likened the chaos of humanity to the rainfall that rained down on her private marriage day, to the permanence that she felt came from the gospel. And while she does not explicitly say that what she's referring to is a polygamous union, as a historian, I have to read into that the events that took place that day, that she was sealed to Joseph Smith. She's trying to figure out why, like, we ask these questions, why would a cultured, educated, civilized woman like Eliza R. Snow enter polygamy? She's asking those questions herself. She's wondering, what have I just gotten into? And it seems like the answer that she came back to was this provided her purpose, that in an American society that left those most vulnerable, people like Eliza R. Snow, who are older, do not have many prospects for marriage and children, who's going to take care of her? What kind of society is it that leaves them, the most vulnerable, on the margins of culture? Here, Mormonism provided a solution, a chance not only to redeem her own life, but to participate in a sanctification project that would redeem the entire world around her.
I want to talk about Emma Smith. I also want to talk about Hiram Smith, Joseph Smith's brother, but let's sort of put them together in some ways because there are some similarities here. Both of them are, both Hiram and Emma, are rigid, maybe even puritanical figures in terms of the way they saw morality within a society. The Relief Society was set out from Emma's perspective to root out iniquity in society. Hiram Smith felt the same way. He also wanted to root out iniquity and infidelity and fornication going on in the community. Ironically, of course, this is going on, these illicit polygamous relationships by her husband and by his brother. But talk a little bit about Hiram and Emma and the fact that they were reacting to a lot of this sexual experimentation that's going on in religious movements throughout the country at that time.
Yeah, I think lots of people already know that Emma Smith had a problem with polygamy. That's a pretty well-known story, and I'll dig into that in a minute. But I was struck by how big of a role Hiram Smith played in this opposition to polygamy. We typically see him as just an assistant to Joseph Smith, his right-hand man and brother, fulfilling everything that the prophet desired. But I find both Hiram and Emma self-dependent, strong-willed, activist figures who are out there to try to not just redeem the world, but redeem Nauvoo. Because they worry, after an episode in early Nauvoo where John C. Bennett, who is Joseph Smith's close friend and mayor of the city, was caught having extramarital affairs, they're worried like, oh my gosh, the very ills that we see outside of Nauvoo are taking place inside of Nauvoo. And they, as well as a group of other individuals, set out to cleanse the city from rampant sexual improprieties. Now, this is going to cause a lot of Joseph Smith conflict, as you can imagine, because just as they are out there trying to do their cleansing project, Joseph Smith is trying to expand his polygamous vision. Now, both of these figures, Emma and Hiram, end up converting to polygamy in May of 1843, almost within a week of each other. Now, it's chance that they had heard pieces of polygamy, but they still haven't heard the full practice of it, and they react to this differently. Hiram converts to the practice because he sees it as a way for him to be sealed to both his deceased wife, Jerusha, as well as his current wife, Mary Fielding. That way, he's able to justify, okay, this practice is a way to unite families together, not just justify extramarital arrangements. And then he becomes the foremost proponent of polygamy, changing from its foremost opponent to proponent. Emma Smith, though, her support of the practice ends up being fleeting. She approves Joseph Smith being sealed to two sets of sisters, but it's likely that she thought he wasn't sealed to anyone else by that point. In fact, two of the sisters that she agreed to Joseph Smith being sealed to had already been sealed to Joseph Smith, so they go through another fake ritual to make it seem like they hadn't already been sealed. And that very same day, or very close to it, she discovers that her close friend Elizar Snow was also sealed to Joseph Smith. And so she is gaining a knowledge about polygamy in bits and pieces, causing a strong reaction and opposing Joseph Smith. So you get these two reactions from Joseph Smith's closest family figures. Hiram converts to the practice, becomes its foremost defender, but he ends up start causing problems because he starts trying to bring others into the order. And in fact, it's that August when he brings the doctrine of polygamy to the group of men that he had been working with to root out polygamy, that those men saw Hiram as betraying their cause and now embracing the practice that they had been trying to oppose. And those group of men who had been working side by side with Hiram Smith now formed the core of the resistance against Joseph Smith within the city, eventually resulting in the dissenting newspaper and Joseph Smith being taken to Carthage jail. And Emma Smith vacillates between accepting the doctrine and rejecting it. At one point, she threatens divorce. At one time, she finds Joseph carrying around love letters from Elizar Snow. And then that fall of 1843, it seems like they have a reconciliation, at least for a short time. But then in March of 1844, just months before Joseph Smith dies, Emma Smith holds a series of public meetings before thousands of saints, denouncing polygamy in the most explicit terms as she had ever done. And this leads to more problems with Joseph Smith. So this problem of polygamy being both secret and practiced and exposed, it's not just a broader Nauvoo story. It's a story that takes place within Joseph Smith's own intimate family.
I don't mean this as a crass or dismissive question, but what would have happened to polygamy if Joseph Smith had not got caught? And what would have happened to the practice if Hiram Smith hadn't said, all right, I'm in, let's give this to everyone? Any way of sensing that?
It's a good question. Joseph Smith was always driven by two principles regarding polygamy. One, he believed it was central to his mission, to this reformation project. And two, he knew how scandalous it would be if it could become exposed. That's where you get these public denials of polygamy, even while he's privately practicing it. So if he never got caught, I imagine he continued would have trying to expand the practice as far as he could until he got caught. So I think the eventual confrontation was in a way inevitable, even at the point at which it took place was probably up in the air. And the same thing with Hiram. If Hiram had been a bit more careful in who he shared it with and the vibrancy with which he shared it, maybe they could have kept it secret for a little while longer. But it seems that by the fall of 1843, the cat was out of the bag and they were having a hard time containing it.
All right. I want to move towards the kind of sort of finale of the story. At least I'm thinking of it that way, and that is the murder of Joseph Smith himself. So Mormon dissidents start spreading rumors, and Mormon dissidents start to grow. The dissenting numbers start to grow. And Joseph Smith, of course, reacts to this dissent and the creation of an anti-Mormon, anti-Joseph Smith newspaper by talking the leaders of the time into demolishing the press. Would you just take us through that particular moment? Because while he talked them into unanimously agreeing to destroy the press, people were saying, whoa, let's wait a minute, because they did know what that meant, I guess.
Yeah, so after the dissenters published their own newspaper, Joseph Smith immediately saw it as a direct threat. He likened it to Missouri, thinking that if this crisis goes on without being checked, we are going to be massacred just like they were at Hans Mill. So he calls the city council together. And Joseph Smith, as a city mayor, had immense power, but he still had to get approval from the city council to do something as radical as destroying a press. And it took 4 intense meetings spread across 2 days for Joseph Smith to convince those in the council that this was necessary. Because there were several people, faithful members of the church on the city council, saying, hey, Joseph, yes, we agree those are bad guys. Yes, they're publishing falsehoods and libel, but this is a big step. I don't think we can actually do it. We've had our own press destroyed. But Joseph Smith was adamant. He saw that if this threat grows big enough and word spreads and this expose goes national, we are sitting ducks. And at one point, Joseph Smith says that I would rather die then let that press live on for another week. Words that end up being a bit prophetic. So I think his actions that seem quite radical from our perspective can only be understood within the context of where everything was life and death. And Joseph Smith believed that, sure, I'll take legal repercussions for this, because I know that the repercussions, if this press stays longer, are even more severe.
Let's talk about June 27th, 1844. It's the day Joseph Smith is killed. And you write about the large group of men who gather in Warsaw, Illinois at first to do this. They called themselves the Warsaw Committee of Safety. There were a number of these similar kinds of committees that were developed, for example, in the Revolutionary War, which was interesting. I hadn't realized that. And of course, they're thought of certainly by mainstream Mormons today and most people as a mob. And maybe they are. Maybe they are a mob. But you also mentioned that they had a kind of well thought out justification for what they were wanting to do. They wanted to kill the Mormon prophet, but they believed that there was some urgency in doing that. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There's a stereotype we have for mobs of people just getting their pitchforks and fires and marching out without much thought. They're irrational. But the men who gathered in Warsaw, who call themselves the Warsaw Committee of Safety, drawing on this political legacy that you mentioned, they saw themselves as rational actors. They wrote out a manifesto. I mean, how many mobs do you think of say, hey guys, slow down, put your pitchforks down, we need to write out an explanation to the governor of why we're about to do this. But that's what they did. Because to them, they were trying to preserve liberty and justice. They had seen the Mormons, and Joseph Smith in particular, for years manipulate the political system and find legal loopholes to keep Joseph Smith from being taken to justice. Of 3 separate occurrences, Joseph Smith was arrested, and on 3 separate occurrences, politicians stepped in and found a way for him to escape. And so when Joseph Smith was arrested and taken to Carthage, they were like, we've seen this movie before. We know how it ends. And so to preserve this democratic system, we need to take justice in our own hands. That was a crucial question to me, because as you mentioned, Mormons just kind of see these mob as these, you know, demonic figures who are bloodthirsty, and those outside the church may not just give much thought to these frontier justice. But I wanted to answer the important question, how could a group of law-abiding and otherwise peaceful citizens decide that the only solution was to form a mob and lynch Joseph Smith? And the answer was, just like the Mormons, those outside Nauvoo, those in Warsaw, believe that the democratic system had failed, that the only way that they can find their own solution is to take it in their own hands. And so that's why democracy, I believe, is a story of is a story of democracy in crisis, where both sides of this conflict saw democracy as too malleable, too flimsy, too fragile to actually bring the justice it required, and so therefore they had to find extra legal measures.
There's an image of Nauvoo you write about that comes in 1846. This is when most of the Mormons have gone after Joseph Smith is killed. It's a young man named Thomas Kane. He visits the city, and he comes upon what seems like a ghost town. He said the town lay as in a dream. What's he seeing?
Yeah, he arrives in Nauvoo a few months after the Saints had evacuated. He arrives in the fall of 1846. Now, a majority of the Saints had left in February or March of that year. Some stayed around in summer. Another big group leave in June of 46. And then finally, in August of 1846, the stragglers, those who were either too poor or too sick, are kicked out in what's called the Battle of Nauvoo. But it wasn't really much of a battle. It was kicking out those who don't have the resources to protect themselves. And Thomas Kane arrives just shortly after that battle. In fact, there's militiamen still dancing around the temple, drunken, telling stories of their bravery. And Thomas Kane just is aghast at this city that is full of houses, stores, this big temple, but in reality was a ghost town by this point. Now, if he had just visited the city a year earlier, there would have been nearly 20,000 people within his borders. But by the time he gets it, it's nothing. It's just a few ruffians celebrating the eviction of the last remaining Saints who had held on for too long.
Today, it's a really small town, barely 2,000 residents.
Yeah, and it's remained about 2,000 residents for about a century. They've been pretty consistent there. Now, of course, during the summer, it's flocked by thousands of tourists going to see the sacred destinations at historic homes hosted by both the LDS Church and the Community of Christ. But it's still in many ways just a skeleton of what it once was. Not just the homes that have been destroyed and the temple that has been restored, but the vibrancy and the potency of the radical mission of Nauvoo is missing from when people think about Nauvoo, if they think about it at all, because Nauvoo is one of these stories that doesn't fit into our neat and tidy depictions of American religious liberty and progress. Instead, it's a story of when our democratic system fell apart.
Let me ask you this finally. What do you figure are the legacies of that Nauvoo experience for Latter-day Saints? How true to Joseph Smith's really grand vision of the time did modern Latter-day Saints keep? I mean, because a lot has changed. Racial policies, they changed after Nauvoo. The attitudes toward the power of women, they changed after that. So what do Mormons today, what do they keep from Nauvoo?
Right. A lot of Joseph Smith's proposals have gone by the wayside, and rightly so. I don't think the right solution for the LDS Church today is to establish a theocratic council. But the anxieties that drove Joseph Smith and the Nauvoo Saints, I think, are still very much present. The goals that the Saints wish they could achieve, things like political assimilation, peace, prosperity, were finally accomplished. Now, they were accomplished through other methods, through actually accepting a separation of church and state rather than establishing a theocracy, by assimilating into the broader culture rather than creating their own kingdom. But nonetheless, the LDS Church has reached kind of a prosperous point that Joseph Smith and his followers could only have dreamed about. And to in a certain degree, the LDS Church today is kind of a mirror of... A reverse image of the church in Nauvoo. Rather than being the radical outliers, the LDS Church today is kind of the traditional mainstreamers. They are part of the American culture that back in Nauvoo, the saints were probably anxious to leave.
Benjamin Park, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
Benjamin Park, he's an assistant professor of history at Sam Houston State University. His book is Kingdom of Nauvoo, The Rise and Fall of a Religious Empire on the American Frontier. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we want to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.